ask the only question I ask on this podcast. How's life going?
Life is going great. I just started a job with Southwest Airlines about a month ago, and I'm enjoying it a lot. It's a really good job. I work on the ground at San Francisco International, so it's the official position is called ramp agent, but the guys you see on the ground losing your luggage, quote unquote, that's what I do. So I do so much more than that. I basically service the plane when it's on the ground, and I'm responsible for getting it out of the gate in a reasonable amount of time, and then getting offloaded in a reasonable amount of time when it comes in, and so on and so forth.
Do you ever use those, like, kind of blowing stick things?
Yeah. Yep, I use those.
Oh,
so
that's awesome.
Those are mainly used when you're taking the plane out. There'll be two people on either side of the wings, basically telling traffic, hey, like, there's a plane coming out. So that's what the signals are for, the hand signals are for with the cones. Or the wands, I keep calling them cones. And then when the plane comes in, you use them to marshal the plane in. So you're giving hand signals with them, and you're standing at the back part of the gate, letting the plane come in, and you're marshaling the pilots in. So if they need to make any adjustments, like if they're off on there, because every gate you look at, there's a line that the planes need to follow the landing gear on, and if they're off, you have to adjust them, and then you let them know when to stop, where to stop, and then you go ahead and hook all your stuff up and start offloading the plane. So it's a really fun job. I absolutely love it. The pay's good. The benefits are great. And Southwest treats veterans really well, too. So that's an added bonus for me.
Yeah, no, to the listeners, my friend Kyle here is a veteran of the Air Force.
Yep, 5 years. I did 2.5 years in Wyoming, a year in Korea, and then a year in Germany.
Which one did you like better, Korea or Germany? Or is that just too tough to tell?
It's not tough to answer, but I don't have a straightforward answer. So Korea will always be my second home. That was my first overseas experience, and it was a very unique environment, and it was a very unique set of circumstances, because I was only there for a year, and you only do year-long tours there, or 2-year-long tours at that base, or those bases, I should say, in Korea. Korea was a really unique experience for me. I met amazing people, some of the best people I know in the military I met in Korea. It was my first overseas culture, and I loved the culture because it was so different from Western culture. Germany was great because of the history and where I was near Kaiserslautern, Germany. I was just outside of the German city of Kaiserslautern, and if you look on a map, it's not even an hour from the French border on the western border of Germany there. So I was pretty much central to everything in Europe. So I got to do a lot of traveling when I was there, got to see a lot of history, and the cultures were cool, the people were cool, but nothing will compare to Korea for me. Korea will always be that, just it has a very special place in my heart. And I was there during all the tensions with Kim Jong-un. Mm. Like, I got there February 2017, left February 2018. And that's right when the tensions started, and that's right when they ended. So it was.
What did you do? No, I'm kidding.
Yeah, I know, right? My family would say that I cursed the country, and I'm like, I didn't do anything. I just got there at a bad time, I guess. I don't know. But it was a really interesting experience. You know, while people, and there's a big, heavy party culture there. So while people are freaking out, like, oh my God, he fired off another missile, we're going to go to war, I'm getting trashed on a Tuesday night, like, just minding my own business. So, you know, it was a really unique experience, like I said. And I will always have very fond memories of Korea.
That's awesome. Yeah, I didn't think that's one way to react. Oh no, we're all going to, let's party.
Well, I mean, so, like, there's not much we could do about it.
Yeah, no, that's a good way. Because
we were there for like a deterrence thing. That's what the U.S. forces in Korea are there for, is to deter North Korea and to aid the South Koreans. So, you know, if war ever did break out there, it wouldn't just be the Americans fighting North Koreans. It wouldn't just be the South Koreans. It would be South Koreans, the Americans, Japanese, other allied nations helping out the South Koreans. But I was at Kunsan Air Base, which is the furthest south of the two air bases we have. We have Osan Air Base in Kunsan. Osan's kind of pretty close to the DMZ. It's like not even, I don't even think it's like 60 miles away. It's pretty close, which is like from, you know, here in Benicia to Sacramento. Like, that's how close the DMZ is to Osan. It's not far. It was at the point where North Korean artillery could hit Osan. All they'd have to do is come south just a few miles, and then they could be in range of attacking Osan. So we were always told, down at Kunsan, hey, if war breaks out, Osan's going to get hammered, and whatever survives, that's coming down to us, and we're holding the line for a few days while reinforcements come in from Japan and Guam. So that was, it didn't really kick in the severity of the situation until later in my tour towards the fall when Kim Jong-un really started acting wild, and then he fired that missile over Japan, and that's when he blew up his research facility and radiation started leaking into China, and China got upset about that and all that. Mm-hmm. That was around the time when all of us there were like, okay, this is actually pretty serious. We might actually be going to war, because we were staging forces at various bases. We were staging forces at my base. We had a couple Green Beret teams chilling at my base, and I'm like, guys, I leave in 3 months. I'm not trying to go to war right now. So it was, like I said, really unique time to be there.
That's a story to remember too.
Yeah, and then I went to the DMZ in January of 18. I left in February, and I went to the DMZ about 2 weeks after one of the defectors who'd crossed right around New Year's. The one who he got shot like 5 or 6 times. He ended up surviving, but yeah, that was one of the big, because I think there was like 4 or 5 defectors when I was there. That were crossing, that were big in the news, and that was like the biggest one during my tour. And I went up there like 2 weeks after it happened, and so the Army private giving the tour up there, he was funny. He goes, if you look off to your left, that's where that guy got shot. We can't go over there. The North Koreans are really touchy about that right now. And the really eerie thing was, because that really famous area where you see the North Koreans on their side, the South Koreans on their side. That's inside the DMZ itself. Like that is inside the demilitarized zone. That is not on the South Korean side. That's not on the North Korean side. It is smack dab in the center of the DMZ. The day we went, it was a really cold January morning. I'm talking like 17 degrees. Like, it was really cold for what I'm used to. There were no North Koreans on their side. It was really eerie. But like, we were under video surveillance. They told us, because when we even went on the tour, we were told, don't wear any offensive shirts. Don't make any offensive hand signals towards the North Korean side, because that could be potentially considered a international incident. So we're like, oh wow. So like, it was a very humbling experience, especially getting up to the DMZ, because it's from where I was at was about a 4.5-hour bus ride up to the DMZ from my base. And we were pretty far south. We weren't all the way south, but we were pretty much in the southern end of the country, on the southwestern end, on the Yellow Sea. So that bus drive, one, was absolutely beautiful. If you've never been to Korea, I highly recommend going. It's nothing but mountains and valleys, and it's just absolutely gorgeous. There's not a whole lot of open space, and when there is, there's just cities dominating it, or large amounts of rice fields and farms and what have you. So the country itself is absolutely gorgeous and so much different than Western infrastructure, if you will. But going up to the DMZ, when we got like 20 miles out, the freeways were empty. There were no cars. I mean, there were cars, but it was the same amount of traffic as if you were driving at 2 a.m. in the morning in the Bay Area, which was really interesting.
It's a weird feeling.
At 2 o'clock in the afternoon, when there's not even a dozen cars on the freeway for any direction that you can see, it was kind of like, whoa, this is weird. And then there's a natural river that divides the two countries. The border is really close to this river. And on the southern embankment, all you see is pillboxes and bunkers manned by South Korean soldiers, by Republic of Korea Army soldiers. And you're like, wow, this is real. This is what I'm here for. So that was a very humbling experience when I actually got up to the DMZ. Because then, you know, I was there for 10 months at that point in the 12 months of my tour. And the whole time I'd been there up until that point, you know, I've been told, oh, we're here to deter North Koreans. Then I actually get up there and see the actual stuff in effect. And then it goes, okay, you know, then that's when you get humbled and you're like, wow, okay, this is real. This is what we're here to do. This is why this is the way it is. So it was definitely surreal. Still one of the best experiences I had in Korea. So I like I said, it just, there were so many good things that happened when I was out there to me, that it will always forever be the greatest experience in my life.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that.
Really. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Where to go from here?
Yeah, I know, right?
I mean, and then from after Korea, you went to Germany, or was it Germany first?
No, I went to Germany after Korea.
Okay. And there, yeah, you were mostly just kind of
Well, so I was an Air Force cop, or Security Forces is the official term. Basically, it's an MP. It's the same thing. But Air Force, Security Forces guys are unique in the fact that they do law enforcement and security. I don't know how it is with other branches. I mean, I've talked to MPs from other branches, and from what I can tell, they do security and law enforcement too, but the Air Force tries to make us seem super special. But basically, I guarded nuclear weapons in Wyoming. Like, I didn't do anything law enforcement related. I literally was trained on various weapon systems and told, hey, go guard these nuclear weapons, and you're basically authorized to kill anybody who tries to steal them. And it's like, oh, okay, cool. Ooh, that's a little sketchy. And then I get to Korea with a little bit more law enforcement. But mainly, like, the real orientation of the mission out there was base defense and deterrence and then law enforcement. And then I got to Germany, and I got there at a really small support base. It's called the Vogelway Cantonment, or Vogelway Air Base is what everyone called it. It's a really tiny installation, 10 minutes down the road from Ramstein Air Base, which is the largest air base in Europe, and that's NATO headquarters. So we were a support base for that. And that whole area of right outside of Kaiserslautern, if you take an area about the size of Rhode Island, roughly around the same size, that has the largest concentration of Americans outside the states at about 60-some thousand, from active duty to civilian contractors and all their dependents, like, so all their families, you know, spouses, children, stuff like that. There's about 67,000-68,000 of us living out there. So I basically acted like a sheriff's office working with the German Polizei, or the German police, and we were basically, like I said, like we were basically like a sheriff's office responding to any American-related incidents within that whole area. So the whole area itself is called the Kaiserslautern Military Community, or the KMC. So this whole KMC, the size of Rhode Island, hey, you've got a call 40 minutes away. It's a domestic violence. You got to go respond to it. Oh, crap. Okay, cool. And so that was my job out there. I absolutely loved it. I had a lot of DUI experience. Got to break up a lot of bar fights because downtown Kaiserslautern had a lot of bars. And there was a bunch of soldiers in the area. There's a lot of army bases. So the Air Force didn't have a whole lot of installations. We had only a few installations there, but there were, in the KMC, there were a bunch of Army installations. So that's most of that population I was talking about was Army. So there were a lot of soldiers that liked to fight. So we would go downtown and break up bar fights, and it was an incredibly awesome experience. I'm not saying I like beating the crap out of people or getting the crap beaten out of me. I'm not saying that at all.
What was, if I could ask, the weirdest, like, bar fight you had to break up?
The weirdest one, well, so I was off duty, I didn't have to break it up, but the weirdest one I witnessed was it was during the World Cup. Germany had just beaten Sweden,
I think it was in
one of the semi games.
Did they make it to the next round? This was the last World Cup, right?
No, this would have been in 2018.
That's the previous World Cup.
Yeah.
I don't think they made it to the next round.
No, they didn't make it to the next round. But so that game where they beat Sweden. So I was downtown with those same bars I was talking about.
I'm half Mexican, and Mexico beat Germany in the first game of the World Cup.
They did.
And I was
remember
so
that because
ecstatic.
A lot of the Germans were upset about that.
I was so ecstatic.
I remember that, but continue. So, So we were downtown in downtown Kaiserslautern, or K-Town, as all the Americans called it. So we were in downtown K-Town, and we were at all the bars, and there was this one bar, it's called Hahnenfoss, and it was up on a second story, and then we were at the Barcode, was the name of the other bar. So we're down at Barcode watching the game, and we're just, like, seating's packed, you know, because soccer or football is huge in Europe. You know, like, it's bigger than football. American football
is
bigger
around the world,
except for
America.
Yeah, right. It's even bigger than baseball or basketball or hockey or American football. It's bigger than all that over in Europe. So when we went, we didn't sit down. We literally just stood in kind of the alleyway just watching the TV, because they had all the bars had TVs set up outside the restaurant. They had TV. They had a lot of their windows open so that people could look in and watch the game. So Hahnenfoss was getting their signal about 2 minutes faster than we were, or not about 2 minutes, but like probably about 30 seconds faster than we were. So we'd hear Han and Foss get all excited. We'd be looking at the TV anxiously waiting for something to happen. And so like it was a really awesome experience. And all of a sudden, everyone was drunk. Everybody was drinking because that's what people do in Europe. They watch soccer games and they get absolutely hammered when they do so. So right when Germany beat Sweden, the whole alleyway of bars just erupted with cheering and everyone celebrating. And then all of a sudden I start watching this German dude in a pink tutu just start swinging at people because he was so excited. He just started getting violent and just started punching at people.
Wow. Okay.
Right? The one thing I'm going to say that for anyone who listens to this and for you is, if you've never seen what German cops do, it is absolutely terrifying. Their use of force laws are so much different than the States. And we would hear stories about it and then not believe it till we actually saw it. And it was kind of crazy because, so we had, like my unit had walking patrols down in the bars in downtown K-Town. Mm-hmm. So we saw guys that we knew. Because we were off duty, they were just on the opposite shift. So we saw him, we talked to him for a couple minutes, and we watched the game. Game ends, and this bar fight breaks out, right? So those guys responded to that. Because whether or not Americans are involved, they're still going to respond to something, too. Because we have that status of force agreement with the Germans. But the Polizei don't show up. When they show up with backup, it's not one or two Polizei. It's like 15 or 20. Right. Yeah. Polizei doesn't screw around. They roll around in force. So I see our two guys come flying to try to break up the fight, and then immediately around the corner, because there's a Polizei station not too far, like two or three blocks down the street, and purposely, because that's where all the Americans drink, that's where all the Germans drink, alcohol incites violence incites someone needing to respond to that. So it was smart for the Polizei to put the Polizei station down there. Well, we see, I'm not kidding, I lost count after about 14 Polizei cops come sprinting around the corner, and they just threw themselves into this crowd because this fight with this, I call him German tutu man, but with the pink tutu guy, he swung at about two different guys, and that was a fight of three that turned into a fight of like 15 people just slugging at each other. And I literally watched a Polizei cop grab one of the assailants, grab an empty beer mug, and just break it over his head.
Oh, any means necessary, I see.
Exactly. And like I said, we'd heard the stories, didn't believe it. You know, if an American cop had done that, people would be calling for that guy's head.
Oh, but here, that's a Tuesday. No, I mean there.
Yeah, over there, that's a Tuesday night for them. Over here, people would want that guy's head on a spike. And they'd be demanding he be in prison for the rest of his life. You know what I mean? Like, so when I saw that, I mean, mind you, I was pretty drunk that night, too, because I was trying to enjoy myself.
Yeah.
And so I watched this German cop break this beer mug over this dude's head, and I'm like, whoa, that's not cool. But it got, I mean, obviously it knocked the dude out. They put him in handcuffs and took him away. And once the other assailants, or the other belligerent guys, saw that, they all kind of calmed down, and the other Polizei guys put him in cuffs and took him away. But I was just like, wow, that was wild.
I mean, that's one way to get the job done.
Yeah, but like, I guess a lot of Polizei cops were dying in the line of duty, I think in like the late 80s or early 90s. So Germany changed a lot of its laws in regards of use of force. So a lot of stuff Polizei could do, we couldn't do. So one thing is in the States, you know, say you're driving drunk and I need your consent to take your blood for blood alcohol content levels readings. You could tell me no. In Germany, they don't need consent, which was the funny thing, because we don't have a U.S. federal court system over there, obviously, because it's a different nation.
So you're following their laws.
So we follow their laws. So the cool thing was our status of forces agreement with them, we had a double whammy in effect. So if I got a DUI on an American installation, obviously I'm going to get charged under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, the UCMJ. The Germans could still charge me for a DUI because it's their country. So we would have Americans that we'd arrest for DUIs, or the Germans would arrest me, like, hey, we have him down our station, come get him, or come get her. Okay, cool. We would go pick up our suspects. But there was a particular incident where this guy, he blew a .26, which, if you don't know what that means, but it's about 26% of his blood is alcohol. That means he's very, 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 very drunk. Or not He's not like super drunk, but he's up there. He's there. Well, they caught this guy at a random DUI checkpoint, and the Polizei cop said he was driving perfectly fine, which that tells you right there that guy's probably a functioning alcoholic. But yeah, so me and my partner, and we had German civilians that worked with my unit, so they were called ZPs or civilian Polizei, civilian police. So the ZPs would work with my unit with security forces, so they were just like us. Well, one of them, he'd been there for like 15 years. Well, I was his partner that night, so he was the lead on the patrol, and I was his alpha. So he's telling me about this story of this guy that he watched get choked out by Polizei so that they could take his blood, and I didn't believe it. Well, we get down to the Polizei station, and this guy who'd blown that .224, .23, whatever it was, he was refusing to give his blood, and he was being really belligerent. And this Polizei guy literally watched. I'm not going to try to impersonate his accent, but he literally was like, we can take your blood, we don't need your consent. And the American's like, well, I have rights. And he's like, you don't have American rights, you have German rights because you fall under German law. And he goes, we can do this one of three ways. Way number one, we ask for your blood, you give it to us, and you go on your way. Way number two, we ask for your blood, you fight us, we tie you, or not tie you down, we hold you down and take your blood. Or three, we knock you out and take your blood, your choice. And so the guy kept wanting to fight because he was just really belligerent, really drunk. And I watched this Polizei cop put him in a chokehold and make him pass out. And then the Polizei guy looks to the medical paramedic person and goes, hey, you can take his blood. Yeah, stuff that you would never, ever see fly in the United States.
It just happens
out there. And man, I always tell people, guys, like,
they're getting paid. They just have to wait it out. They're going to do their job.
Yeah. And I always tell people, like, you don't understand how good you have in the States. You could be somewhere else and you could be getting your ass kicked by the cops. And that's a normal Tuesday for them. So it's just people don't understand how good they have it out here when it comes to stuff like that.
Yeah, I remember reading a story. This is in Japan, like Japanese cops, the way they kind of handle situations.
Oh, I've heard they're crazy too.
Yeah. Like some of it's funny. Like I don't know if this is true, but I read somewhere online that someone was just kind of drunk and didn't want to, like he wasn't being able to put handcuffs on him. So they just rolled him up in the mattress.
Yeah, that's funny. like I said, foreign law enforcement is so much different, and obviously every country's laws are going to be different than ours, but it's just funny, especially when you see civilian dependents of military, so like, you know, spouses, what have you, who were civilians. They would watch something happen downtown and be like, oh my God, they can't do that. Yes, they can. It's German law. And that's what passes out here. Like, people don't understand, and it's a bit of a culture shock for them. And then it humbles them a bit, too, because they realize
how much they have it here.
Well, it's not even how good they have it. It's just things are that much different. Mm-hmm. Like I said, all that stuff I just said about those Polizei cops, that would never fly if American cops did that in the States. If an American cop did that with a beer mug or even choking out dudes to get their blood... Mm-hmm. That's not going to fly here. I mean, that was the nice thing about the German status of forces agreement we had with them was you fall under German laws. Okay, cool. We fall under German laws. And the double whammy was nice, too, because we could always charge for crimes that happened on American installations or American-related incidents. If it was an American civilian contractor, because we arrested one guy one night. He got into a bar fight. He beat the crap out of some Germans. And unfortunately, we couldn't really charge him with anything because he was a civilian contractor. And it was a little bit more sticky of a situation with the JAG to be able to get the charges to stick because he's a civilian contractor. He's not actual active duty military. Mm-hmm. Or he's military affiliated. He's not actually military serving. So the Germans were able to still slap him with domestic violence and assault charges. So that's where that double jeopardy came in play, and I really liked when that happened because you see these crimes of people and then they get away scot-free on our end because it's hard to charge them because they're civilians, but then the Germans go, hold on, you're getting fined 500 euro, which is about 560 bucks, 500 $450, so, and then, you know, they could still do jail time in German prisons or German the German prison system, whatever. So that's where that came into effect, and that really helped us a lot on a lot of our crimes where we couldn't charge American individuals who weren't military.
Wow.
Yeah.
See, what I imagine when you like say the German police when they went into that one bar fight you were talking about, I imagine that one meme where it's like, oh, we got him, and like they send in.
Yeah.
That's what I imagine that their Tuesdays are like.
Yeah, well, you know, like it was just funny because me and my friends weren't the only Americans down there. And a lot of us that were down there were cops from my unit. And so we saw that bar fight break out, and we saw two of our friends from the other shift who were on patrol, and we're like, hey, go get them, guys. And then we see the bullets like come running around. We're like, oh my God. And all of us, of course, you know, we're a bunch of dumb young enlisted. We're recording this on Snapchat, watching the German cops beat the crap out of people. It was wild. Yeah, it was the best 5 years of my life. I mean, I absolutely enjoyed every minute of, well, okay, I can't say every minute of service. But there were definitely some rough times. Yeah. I went through a really bad personal time in Wyoming, which is why Korea was one of the reasons why it was so good for me, because it was kind of that light at the end of the tunnel. Wyoming was a base where once you got stationed there, you really didn't leave, and you just did your whole enlistment there. And I'd signed up for 6 years, and I really wasn't looking to do 6 years in Wyoming. It really wasn't about that. And I did about 2.5 years there. We heard there was a big amount of orders being dropped for the base listings. I was like, you know what? It can't hurt to try to put in for a base. And I did, and I got lucky, and I got out. So
that's awesome.
Yeah. I mean, guarding nuclear weapons wasn't bad. It was easy. It was a really easy job. It was just I had personal stuff in my life that was going on that just didn't make Wyoming a good experience for me. So going to Korea was just that was one of the reasons why it was so amazing, because it was just that light at the end of the tunnel for me. Wyoming was definitely the easiest money I ever made. Obviously, it's a very serious matter because it's nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. But I sat out in a facility 4 or 5 days at a time, guarding nuclear launch sites, and that was it. That was my job. It's just, hey, sit on shift, watch some TV, play some Xbox, go respond to that alarm, or hey, there's a suspicious individual at our launch site, go make sure they can't be there, and go respond. So that was my job out there. That was really easy. And you know, Korea, hey, we're deterring a fat boy, and then Germany's, hey, there's a bar fight, let's go break it up. So amazing experience.
That's awesome. And it's really good to have you back, too, because,
yeah, but it's great to be back.
The listeners don't know, we're trying to work on a project, a writing project. We're going to keep it on the down low, because it's our idea.
We're going to keep it on the DL a little bit, but, yeah, we're definitely collaborating. Yeah, and it is good to be home. It's good to be connected back with all my friends. I've been home for about a year now, so that's nice. And I've got an amazing job, and the job is going to be really good going forward. It'll keep a lot of stability while I want to do writing projects on the side, and then eventually do both things, you know, full time, juggle my schedules around. So
yeah, and that's really great. Like, things are just starting off, like, even though you had that like life there.
Yeah, well, I'll say the military may have ended, but this is just the beginning of a new chapter.
Yeah, we're still young. There's a lot.
I'm about to say when I did get out, it did feel like that was kind of the end of everything. Or, you know, that felt like a kind of a hard ending, but it was really just the ending of a chapter. Mm-hmm. And it took some time to realize. It took a few months to get readjusted.
That's completely understandable.
Yeah. I would say it was hard getting adjusted back to civilian life. But once I did, oh, man, like, don't get me wrong, I love my military service. But if they said, hey, we want you back, I'd be like, I'm good now. I'm in a really good place right now. So I'm not going to jeopardize that, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, anything short of World War III, I don't think I'd ever see myself re-enlisting, just because I'm in a so much better place now with just the just getting out was really turbulent for me. Not that anything bad happened. It's a very turbulent time of my life, and I don't really intend to have that happen again. So I like where I'm at now, and I plan to see where that's going.
That's great to hear.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, thank you for coming on. I'm going to have to kind of cut it short because it's kind of a short week for me recording this. I kind of fell back. I missed last week's episode recording. And I'm trying to do this like kind of a weekly thing.
Yeah, no worries.
And it would be fun to get you back on, like, let's say a year from now and just see where we're at.
Oh, of course. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah. It's always awkward because I just hit the stop button right now.